but 3 million people were still 3 million people. He took some solace in the fact that the reports indicated the Empire had landed an occupational force. That would presumably mean there were survivors, at least. That was better than what they offered with the Drossen atrocities, if nothing else. Tanner's lips drew back in a quiet snarl before he regained control of himself. He got up and crossed the control room to where the coordinator for the Primine forces was working. "Have this information transmitted to our vessels as well as the Odysseus," Tanner ordered, handing over a data chit. "We have lost the colony on Marta III. The Empire has made their first move." The woman paled slightly, but nodded as she shakily took the chit from him and placed it on the scanner beside her.
"The rumors say that they have hundreds of ships," she said, looking to him while the system read the data.
Her eyes clearly said that she was hoping he would refute it, but Tanner just nodded.
"Over 400. Some much larger than the Heroics, I am afraid. The Terrans cost them 4 in exchange for Marta III, but even if that were repeatable, it would not be close to enough. I do not know what happens this time."
She nodded, turning back to the task, quickly sending the data out.
"Sent,"
she said, her expression dark as she did.
"There must be something we can do."
"Our duty."
Tanner's response was instinctive, with no thought of anything else.
"We do our duty. We trust our captains to do theirs, and we do everything in our power to support them. Really, what else is there?"
She had no response, so he turned and headed back to his station. Tanner wondered at his own confident words. He couldn't help but think that there had to be more he could be doing, but it came down to the simple truths. There were not enough ships to go around. If they needed military personnel, they had those. Millions would volunteer instantly if the hulls were there for them, but they weren't. So he would do what he could in the position he was in, while everyone else did the same. AEV Odysseus. On the bridge again, while Steph was working up to requalify on the AA platform and Mila was hard at work on the flight deck, Eric looked over the latest communique from Primine Central Command.
"So it begins."
A smile played at Eric's lips as he spoke the old quote with an ironic lilt to his tone. The reports from Captain Roberts and the rest of the squadron were enlightening, at least. He was both encouraged and concerned. The enemy was occupying worlds. That was good. That put them back on a more conventional battlefield, one that Eric understood and could make far more sense of. Just annihilating planets had made no goddamn sense to him whatsoever. He was aware of the academic arguments concerning space combat and the strategies some of the more nihilistic of his contemporaries supported, but Eric had never felt that they were realistic, given the logistics involved. Unfortunately, based on his understanding of logistical issues, Eric wasn't sure that the occupation of the Primine colony made any sense either. The move was puzzling. In many ways, war in the stars made no sense whatsoever. Any culture that had the capacity to wage war in the stars clearly had no reason to. Resources were easier to gather from the outer systems, and in fact were more plentiful around stars that were inherently incompatible with life. The area around the location of a supernova or neutron star was far more likely to have abundant supplies of valuable materials than that of a young yellow star like Earth's, or any of those likely to have habitable worlds, which meant that the Empire had more than resources in mind. Unfortunately, none of the prisoners they'd captured to date were willing to talk about motivations, or they honestly didn't know. Eric was inclined to think it was more the latter than the former, given the sort of people they'd captured, but it could go either way. Motivation was one of the big missing pieces left, and without it, he had no way to really figure out the puzzle. All he could do was react, and Eric hated being forced into a reactionary position. He looked over the report that had been delivered from Roberts via the Primine, and noted the next likely target star system. It was, of course, an outer Primine colony that lay roughly along a direct line course from the estimated location of the Empire, en route to Rankiel itself.
"I suppose that tells me their likely endgame for this particular maneuver, if nothing else. Of course, their conquest wouldn't stop with Rankiel.
They'd already shown that much in their willingness to unleash the Drossen. The Empire was an expansionist regime, and a violently insane one by some metrics. Eric was a student of military history, to some middling level at least. He'd spent his time learning tactics and strategies from historical leaders, battles, and campaigns, and a great deal of what he was seeing in the Empire was classical expansionist strategy if one were to ignore the initial tactics involving the Drossen. He supposed it wouldn't be the first time in history a group made use of a superweapon that ultimately worked counter to their overall goals. Now, however, they seemed to be operating on a more traditional strategy of taking and holding land. That he could work with, assuming they kept to the game plan, of course. Fat chance of that. "Commander," he called, rising from his station.
"Yes, Captain," Miriam asked, coming over.
"We have our target," he said. "Signal all ships, our Primine friends as well. We're moving out."
"Aye, aye, Captain. Coordinates?" she asked.
"On your station already, Commander. We'll rendezvous with the Bell and Bow upon arrival. I need to see to the new project. Hopefully we'll be far enough along for it to be of some use."
"Aye, sir. I'll see it done."
AEV Enterprise. "Communication from the Odysseus, Captain. We have a destination. I've sent the details to your system."
"Thanks, Lieutenant," James said, and he gestured to light up his personal screens. The details were waiting, of course, as the Lieutenant had told him, and he quickly skimmed through them. As expected, they had vectors and estimated times of arrival for the Imperial forces on the next Primine world. But so far, no plan of action had been sent along.
"I hope Weston has something in mind, or this will be the shortest defense ever mounted," James thought sarcastically as he examined the data with a critical eye. He noted some addendums from the Commodore personally with his name attached.
"What's this?" He whistled as he read the brief. "Well now, isn't that an idea?"
"Lieutenant Massey."
James looked up toward the communications officer.
"Yes, sir?"
"Put me on with the Commodore as soon as we're close enough for a face-to-face," James ordered. "Please inform him that I believe it to be important and attach the information for new missiles."
"Aye, aye, Skipper. We should be in range for real-time conversation in a little under 20 minutes. I'll call ahead to confirm."
"Thank you, Massey."
James shifted back to the file the Commodore had sent over.
Unfortunately, there was no way the Enterprise fabricators could possibly produce even one of the new drones in that period of time, but it did get him thinking about some alternatives. James found himself rather amused by it all.
"I think Weston wins this round. Flying antimatter launches beats hyperlite missiles, not by much, but enough. The added points for sheer balls puts it over the top. What can I come up with for round two?"
AEV Odysseus. "Communication from the Big E, Skipper," the communications officer said. "Flagged for your attention."
"Send it to my station," Eric said as he looked over to his inbox. The message blinked into existence a second or so later, and he brought it up, skimming the document quickly. "Hyperlite missiles. Well now, isn't that an idea? Range isn't much," he noted, "but the kinetic power of the strike should make up for that." He quickly checked the inventory Captain James had sent along with the communication and started to tap out a fast request for a shipment of the devices for the Odysseus to use before he reconsidered his actions. Instead, he signaled down to engineering.
"Chief Garrick, please."
A moment passed while the command was processed and directed to the chief. Then Garrick came on the screen.
"Yes, Captain?"
"Sending you specs," Eric said, shooting the files down to the chief. "I need some of the fabricators shifted over to producing these, fitted for Archangel hardpoints."
"Another project, Captain?" Garrick asked,
eyes flickering to the side to read the file he'd just received. His eyes widened a moment later.
"That is very interesting. I will have to send my compliments to my colleague and have one of the fab units begin turning out components. We should be able to make at least a couple full loads in the time we have before estimated contact."
"Likely more than we'll need," Eric said. "I expect to be withdrawing from contact before we'd be able to reload anyway."
"Very well, Captain. I'll see if there are any improvements I might offer," Garrick said.
"Run it past Lieutenant Shans as well," Eric said. "Her expertise with Primine technology may help."
Yes, indeed it may, sir. I will do so, Garrick said. I'll contact you if anything comes up.
As you were then, Chief. Thank you.
Garrick nodded, and the connection broke. Eric turned back to the endless paperwork he was dealing with as they approached likely combat with the Empire. He sighed and looked at the doctrine he had added to the overall strategies he was planning, hesitating a moment before he gestured and deleted the entire section. Hyperlight missiles. Yep. Going to need to rethink doctrine for sure. On the plus side, Eric was quite certain that James and the Big E had just given him the final piece he needed to bring starfighters and the Enterprise herself right back into the fight. Time to get to work.
Absolutely not!
Stefan, it is useless,
Mila repeated herself for what felt like the thousandth time.
I don't care, Steph grumbled. You don't take away a fighter pilot's gun. It's been tried and it never works. Leave the gun where it is.
Stefan, the enemy uses ships that your cannon simply cannot damage, she said. It is a needlessly complicated, obsolete, entirely superfluous piece of equipment.
Steph chopped his hand through the air, cutting her off.
Then make it better, he said, or leave it as is, but the gun stays.
Mila sighed, slumping slightly.
I will see what can be done.
Thank you, Steph said, then sighed himself.
I'm sorry, Mila. Look, call it superstition if you like, but fighter pilots really don't like to give up our guns, okay? It's not that much extra weight and the system is already there. Just leave it be.
I said I would see what could be done, Mila uttered. I will not remove your gun.
She rolled her eyes and shook her head.
Honestly, you sound like I suggested cutting off your...
Hey, let's not go there.
Around the flight deck, engineers and crew members looked assiduously in any other direction than toward the two arguing officers. Most suffered oddly timed choking fits, but of course no one was eavesdropping. That would be rude.
Chapter 18 Allied Earth Command, Cheyenne Mountain Facility. Grayson's boots clicked on the polished cement floor as she made her way into one of the large, seismically isolated facilities buried deep inside the mountain complex. Like two other similar complexes in Geneva and Tibet, the revamped Cheyenne Mountain facility was one of the keystone command and control complexes that provided a redundant continuity of command for all Earth and Sol-based operations. She walked past two marine guards, entering a cavernous room filled with large screens on every wall, and rows of men and women all secured in their own stations, all surrounding a massive central holographic display that was currently showing an image of the local arm of the galaxy about 500 light-years cubed. Grayson walked down the stairs into the central area, eyes on the highlighted stars. Earth's star was a lone green dot, while the Primine worlds were shown in blue. A solitary red dot showed the now lost world currently under Imperial control. The area of space around the Primine worlds was similarly highlighted with an amorphous blue zone to show the space they claimed as part of their area of control. Earth's green section of space was too small to show up on the current level of display.
Admiral, a young ensign intercepted her. We've prepared your work area, if you'll follow me.
Thank you, Ensign. Please lead the way.
Her work area was a large interactive desk with augmented reality displays, designed to allow her to interact with a large central display as well as work independently. All of her files had already been transferred and were waiting for her when she took her seat. Grayson opened up the relevant ones and settled in. She quietly observed the work around her, since she was largely in a holding pattern until she got more information to work with.
Admiral?
Grayson turned slightly, nodding politely as she recognized the gray-haired man approaching her.
General?
General Maximilian Moore was a stocky, barrel-chested man who had started going gray in his early 30s as a captain and never tried to cover it up, despite the occasional hint that he might get promoted a little quicker if he didn't look 20 years older. Whatever effect his lack of vanity might have had on his career path had been truly offset by the Block War.
When the initial fighting had raged along the west coast, Moore had led the defense of California and held off Bloc forces for 2 months before a counteroffensive had been mounted to push the enemy expeditionary force back out to sea. Certainly the lack of reinforcements on the other side had worked massively in his favor, but it had still been considered a noteworthy accomplishment. And when Moore had gone on to take command of the Army's overall counteroffensive through the Pacific Theater, his eventual ascension to flag rank was assured. At that point, the only question was how high his flag would rise, and the answer had become pretty much as high as possible. Now serving as Chief of Staff of the Army for the Americas, Moore had been expected to accept an appointment to the position of Secretary of Defense upon his mandatory retirement at age 60. Grayson had won a pretty sum when she bet against that, and had been proven right when Moore accepted a presidential waiver to allow him to continue in his current capacity until the end of the current war.
"Not often we get to see you come down from on high, Admiral," Moore said with an affable smile. "Good to see you again."
"Well, I prefer the view from Unity. I can be of more value here in the current situation. We don't need to add even another second or so delay in communications. We'll have enough problems of that type as it stands."
"Very true." Moore looked to the holographic display with frustration. "I feel like a useless tool here, Admiral. All the heavy lifting is going to be done by your boys and girls."
"Only if we win, Admiral," Grayson said. "And that's not likely, I'm afraid. If and when we lose the fight in the skies, you get to show your stuff." Moore chuffed, shaking his head.
"Well, suddenly I find myself hoping to be a useless tool. There's a sensation I've never had before in my life. Thanks ever so much for that, Admiral."
Grayson smiled, amused by the gruff man's tone. "We have a chance, General. I have a couple cards I've been holding back, and I wouldn't count the Commodore out of this just yet either. He has a way of surprising people, I've found."
Moore grunted. "Not his biggest fan, but I won't argue with that. Fought under more than one sky he made friendly, or at least neutral. You really think he can turn something this big around?"
"I said I wouldn't bet against him," Grayson said, before she deflated slightly. "But this time, I don't think I'd put much on him either. It's a tall order, General. At least 20 times his weight of metal, maybe 10 times his firepower. If that was the only thing, he might be able to pull something out, but those Imperial ships are damn tough."
"I thought the Heroics were supposed to be tough, too."
"They are. But with a concentrated fire of more than 10 ships to our one, not that tough, I'm afraid," Grayson said. "And what I'm most concerned with is that, based on interrogations, even this is probably only a small fraction of the Imperial forces, so beating them might just result in them sending even more ships the next time."
"Remind me not to bring the President over for you to cheer up," Moore said. "I'd be half afraid of you talking him right into a noose with that sort of pep talk. I guess it's a good thing we've been increasing militarization across the planet in case those goddamn space spiders ever came back."
"If we're going to stop the Empire, we need to make them think twice before they ever want to come back into our space looking for trouble," Grayson said. "Frankly, there's not too many ways we can hope to do that. I've got a card or two, but right now, I don't know if we have the time to shuffle the deck in our favor. The Commodore's orders are simple, General. Beat the enemy like a drum. But failing that, buy us all the time possible and hope like hell that it's enough."
"I'd ask you about these cards you're holding back, but I don't doubt they're in the briefings I've not been able to make heads or tails of already," Moore said, shaking his head. "This is a younger man's job. All this sci-fi horror bullshit isn't what I trained for. I came up killing terrorists, Admiral, not fighting space aliens."
"None of us train for this, General. We adapt or we die."
"Not curling up yet," Moore said. "Don't worry about that. I'll do my job. I just wish there were someone better for it."
"I wish there were someone better for your job, too, General. Hell, I wish there were someone better for mine and the Commodore's. We're up at bat, and we don't get to call in a pinch hitter."
"Right you are, Admiral, right you are. I'll leave you to your work, then. Send along any new briefs when you can. The Secretary of Defense will want to be up on all the latest before the President comes demanding updates again."
"You'll have them before you get back to your desk, General." Moore nodded firmly before taking his leave. Grayson watched him go for a moment before sending along the file she'd promised him. He was right about one thing. She wished there were better people for all their jobs, too. Humans built such fun and yet oddly dreary places. Gaia didn't often observe the world through a single perspective. It was simply unnecessary, really, and so limiting. Billions of eyes, ears, and senses of all kinds were a superior way to experience the universe. Occasionally, though, she liked to intentionally narrow her perception to a single position, not entirely unlike humans might experience the world, at least in terms of limitations. Focusing her perception to one location had taken a great deal of practice and experience over the centuries, and millennia, and more. She couldn't exactly limit herself to human perceptions, of course. Hearing was impossible for her, strictly speaking, as she didn't have ears. She sensed things through the electromagnetic spectrum, and sound waves were kinetic energy passing through a medium. She could detect the effects those kinetic waves had on the environment, however, so adjusting for that lack was not difficult. Glass would vibrate, and she could see the vibrations as they altered the path of light, for example. It was easier, of course, if a human was present, since then she could expand her senses just enough and use their eardrums in much the same way. Underground in a polished stone maze, however, she had to get creative. Presenting herself for all who might see her in passing as a uniformed Navy commander with all the appropriate clearances, altering computer records along the way, Gaia mimicked the intent march of those around her as she moved through the base known to modern humans as Cheyenne Mountain. It was really just the latest name of many, of course. People had been naming mountains for as long as people had been living in the shadows of them, and nearly uncountable generations had given the three peaks some name or another. Since the mountains had become home for the American and, later, the Confederation military, it had become a much more interesting place to visit. She had walked the corridors during various times of interest. The first nuclear crisis the base experienced had been fascinating to observe from the still unfinished facility of the time. So little of it had been complete then that the observers had used gear run from portable generators trucked in for the occasion. That disaster had been averted, along with many others over the decades that followed. But each time the tension had been real and palpable. When possible, Gaia rather enjoyed that sensation, but she had never been able to experience it the way humans did. And now the new unknowns brought into her sphere from the black of space afforded her vastly different experiences than she had ever been able to manage in the past. Over the centuries, Gaia had fooled herself into thinking that by limiting her perception, she could feel what humans felt. But now, with added perspective, she knew for certain that was a lie. This time she couldn't know the other side of the equation. Even having cut off her perception during the various crises that occurred purely on Earth, she had always been on some level fully aware of both sides of the conflict. She'd know what everyone involved was capable of, what they believed, what they were prepared to risk. This time, she had no clue. No more than the humans did, at least. And Gaia found that she detested that sensation. It was wrong, unnatural, and she was scared. She didn't know how to handle fear, such an alien sensation to experience firsthand. The Drossen had come, and she hadn't been able to control them, it was true, but there had been no time for fear then. She had become enraged. Now, though, this empire seemed just as bad or near enough. They wanted to change everything, and Gaia didn't know how their efforts would change her. Millennia, a hard thing to rewrite, true, but an alien genocidal assault might just be enough to accomplish the feat. So she was scared. She could admit it, to herself at least. Saul knew it, and she could feel him mocking her for it even in her current state of lessened awareness, but she didn't care. He was a standoffish piece of work at the best of times. Thinking he was so far removed from her affairs and those of the humans, even though she believed that Eric was right about all of their kind. Without humans, without that intelligence to form her thoughts, to mold her way of thinking, Gaia was all but certain that she would be nothing more than a bestial mind at best, perhaps nothing at all at worst. She was a gestalt of every human alive, and who had ever lived, and if she was that, then so was Saul, whether he wanted to admit it or not. Perhaps they were both more than that. She was willing to believe that as well, but their foundation was still deeply rooted in human intelligence. Without them, she felt that she would never have been. Now humans were under threat, and she desperately wanted to help, and yet there was nothing she could do. Gaia was more than afraid. She was frustrated and royally pissed off. She turned the corner of the corridor she was traversing and made her way toward Central Command.
"We're online with Rankiel."
Grayson looked up at the pronouncement, noticing large screens on each side of the room now showing the Central Command base of the Primine Core world, and railed Tanner as the focus of the image. She didn't even want to know how much power was required to manage a real-time FTL link with Rankiel, because she was sure it was a significant chunk of the Confederation's power consumption. "Admiral Tanner," Grayson said, looking down at the image of Rael floating above her desk rather than across the room. "Good to see you again."
"And you, Admiral Grayson?" Tanner said, inclining his head slightly. "Your Commodore Weston has just transitioned out of Rankiel's space and is now en route to the Shiran system. Or already arrived, I suppose."
Grayson looked up and across to a lieutenant and gestured in his direction with a snap of her fingers. While he was jumping to update the holographic map, she looked back at the Admiral.
"Thank you for the update," she said. "Do we have any further information on the Imperial force?"
"Yes. Updates from your Bellerophon and Boudica," Tanner said, transmitting the reports, "as well as sightings from many of your own ships. Your vessels engaged the Imperials in combat already. 4 ships lost on the Imperial side, none, as of this time, on your own."
Grayson frowned slightly, calling up the reports. "Interesting. They managed to deploy a minefield without being detected. Not a great hit ratio, but better than I might have expected in deep space."
"The Imperial forces are leaving a rather impressive path to follow and calculate via subquanta interference," Tanner answered. "That, combined with the large depression of their drive warps, does make it easy to predict and intercept them. That information is of limited value, unfortunately, given their combined firepower."
"And I have no doubt they'll be looking for a similar trick in the future," Grayson acknowledged with a sigh. "Can you manufacture more of the mines the crews of the Bellerophon and Boudica cobbled together?"
"Yes, we have the specifications and are working on improving their effectiveness," Tanner responded. "The design is very basic. Manufacturing them in large quantities will not be difficult."
"Add stealth measures," Grayson said. "Use black hole cam plate settings at the very least. Make them hard to detect. Might get us a few more kills before they just start sweeping space indiscriminately."
"I'll issue the orders," Tanner confirmed. "In the meantime, Commodore Weston had sent additional files to me for redirection to yourself. He and engineers from his ships and the Forge have been working on another concept, one somewhat more disturbing than creating artificial singularities out of a ship's warp field."
An Air Force Brigadier General across the room coughed, looking up from where he had been observing the conversation at his desk. When he realized everyone was looking at him, he spoke quickly.
"There's something more disturbing than turning a ship's own drive warp into a black hole?" the Brigadier asked somewhat incredulously.
"Read the file," Rael suggested dryly.
Everyone in the room with access was silent as they quickly skimmed the file, those with any passing knowledge of antimatter cringing as they did.
"Trust the Commodore," Grayson muttered. "Well, he's not asking for permission, but file 9 retroactively anyway. Hard times and all that. Flying antimatter drones. Jeez."
"He's in violation of multiple international treaties,"
the same Brigadier General sputtered, his tone a little unbelieving.
"This is insane!"
"I believe you'll find," Moore said, grabbing everyone's attention, "that he is not. The treaties you're referring to only covered Earth's atmosphere and orbit, along with other parts of the solar system in some cases. So long as he doesn't bring any of those drones back into solar territory, he is entirely clear of any treaty violations. I'm not sure where it would fall if he brings them back while powered down. Anyone?"
Moore looked toward a man in an expensive suit who simply shrugged before replying,
I would have to reread through the pertinent sections. However, I believe that we covered that eventuality already. So long as the weapons are not armed or deployed, they do not violate the specified treaties. In the current situation, I believe we could convince the Bloc to extend a temporary exemption, however.
Then we needn't worry about it, Moore said with a grim smile. Let the Commodore have his toys. Lord knows where he's going, he'll be needing them.
Grayson had nothing to add to that, so she shifted her attention and examined the rest of the reports. The situation with the Imperials was beginning to remind her of what one might expect from playing video games. Each wave just got a little tougher and more deadly than the last, building to the inevitable boss battle, assuming you lived long enough to get that far. It was a pattern she didn't have much taste for, and had spent significant time trying to break. Life wasn't a video game, and she wasn't tied down to the rules as a player might be.
There must be a way to flip this script, dammit.
She cast her attention over to the sealed and heavily classified Prometheus file.
We need more time. Eric, buy us time. Admiral?
A cool contralto voice startled her, causing Grayson to look up and to the side where the speaker was standing. She recognized the uniform first.
Yes, Commander, what?
Grayson blinked, then looked closer, and her eyes widened.
You. Yes, Admiral. It is a pleasure to meet you again.
Gaia smiled at her. Grayson narrowed her eyes, leaning over and hissing at the entity who had invaded the most secure facility on the continent.
How did you get down here?
All right, a stupid question, she supposed, and she recognized that as soon as she said it, but she was rather angry.
Silly question, Admiral,
Gaia responded, amused.
I walked, of course.
Grayson leaned back. That had not actually been the answer she was expecting.
You what?
Walked, Admiral, Gaia said, clearly only just containing her mirth.
It is when you put a single foot forward in front of the other, and then repeat the process until you arrive at your destination. Slow, perhaps, but effective.
Grayson hadn't been openly mocked in some time, as generally that sort of thing went away long before you reached flag rank.
You're so lucky that rank is fake, she growled under her breath. Oh, I beg to differ, Admiral,
Gaia preened slightly.
It's completely real, as far as any of your records will show, at least. How do I look?
Like a porn star pretending to be an officer, Grayson snapped, looking around to see if anyone was paying attention to their conversation. No one appeared to be, thankfully, since they were in a somewhat open meeting with aides and messengers furiously coming and going.
Why did you walk down here? Well, if I had just appeared, it might be noticed. By walking, not only do all the computer records show me present and actually moving through the appropriate checkpoints, but all the guards remember me. I made quite sure of that.
Grayson growled. In the future, since I suppose it's quite pointless for me to ask you to not impersonate an officer, I would appreciate it if you didn't choose a stripper version of the commander's uniform.
I did no such thing.
Gaia looked affronted.
This is to uniform specifications. I merely tailored it precisely.
No commander anywhere in the Confederation could afford to have that uniform tailored so
precisely. So in the future, try to look nondescript,
Grayson said.
If I feel like it, though I warn you, I rarely feel nondescript when I'm in character, invisible is my definition of nondescript.
Invisible would be fine, thank you. Gaia merely smiled and looked toward the center of the room.
I believe they're beginning to wonder what you're talking to a mere commander about.
Grayson huffed out, irritated, but focused on her job as she tried to get her head back into the game.
How the hell did Eric put up with these pains in the ass without blowing his lid all the time?
He got off-world, Gaia answered quietly from behind her.
Far, far off-world, as quickly as he possibly could.
Lucky bastard. Chapter 19 AEV Odysseus, Chiron System, Primine Space.
No signs of anyone yet, sir.
Eric frowned, checking the scans for himself after the commander's words.
That's odd, he said finally. I would have expected the bell and the bow to have beat us here.
They might be running silent, sir, Miriam suggested.
Possibly, but there's no reason for it. Last ETA gave us days before the Imperials arrived, Eric said, making a snap decision. All right, give me a system-wide pulse.
Miriam looked at him, surprised. Are you certain, sir?
Yes. Minimal risk at this point. The enemy is too far out and under heavy power. They won't detect it, and even if they did, it's not that unusual for a system scan to happen in an occupied star system. Give me a full system ping.
Aye, aye, Skipper. Scanners. Full system ping, Miriam called out.
Full ping. Aye, ma'am.
Eric settled back, the tone ringing through the bridge to announce the tachyon pulse going out. The faster-than-light particles scattered across the system, a few returning to be detected by the ship's scanners. In moments, they had a better idea of what the system held. No sign of any ship, sir, Miriam said, turning back. Eric wondered where Roberts and the bell had gotten to, but with no other option than to trust his subordinate and wait, he gestured simply.
As you were, then. Stand down from general quarters. We have some time to prepare for our guests, he told those on the bridge. Normal shifts. Get some rest. When it hits the impeller, we're going to be here for a long while if we're good and lucky.
Everyone nodded as he looked around, pleased with the expressions he was seeing.
We faced worse odds, Eric laughed lightly, trying to convince himself as well as the others of the statement. So I intend to relax, at least until we figure out where the bell and the bow got off to. They reported that they had departed the last system with no issues, so I expect that Captain Roberts decided to change up the game. They're big boys and girls and can take care of themselves. I want everyone here working to ensure that when they get here, we're ready to greet them with plenty of firepower and support. We've faced the block together. We fought alien monsters from space that literally tried to eat our planet. We dealt with them. We'll deal with the Empire.
He logged out of his station and looked around once more before he left, a much more optimistic group of people in his wake. Inside the lift heading for the flight deck, Eric found himself unsurprised when he suddenly had company.
You didn't believe a word of what you just said, and most of them knew it, Odysseus said, confused. But they don't care?
The entity was in his normal armor, but had removed the helmet for the moment. Eric noted that he had applied, or perhaps visualized, the makeup around the eyes a little differently. His lips were purple this time. Eric smiled somberly.
It isn't about reality, Odysseus. It's about hope. And hope is always a lie.
I don't understand.
Hope is something you have when nothing else will save you. There may be limited evidence that the desired outcome will happen, but just the chance of said outcome is enough to sustain us. Hope is a lie, but the universe has ways of making some lies into truth, so we'll believe the lie and then work like hell to help the universe make up its mind in our favor.
But what if it doesn't work?
Then we die. But we die on our terms, with no regrets.
I still don't understand,
Odysseus said, clearly bothered.
You will.
The lift slowed to a stop, and Eric got up.
Just trust in the crew.
They trust in you.
Odysseus said as the doors opened.
I'm the captain.
Eric stepped off and into the corridor, leaving Odysseus behind as the doors closed.
It looks like you took away my baby's clothes and left her naked out in the cold, Steph grumbled as he looked at what had once been his fighter.
All the stealth plating had been stripped away, exposing many of the internal workings of the fighter to the open air. That was fine, he supposed, given that most of the internal workings were now strewn across the deck in various junk piles. Fuel lines, tanks, hydraulics, and practically everything but the original airframe were now gone. Even the airframe hadn't been entirely spared, having been chopped and modded to support the Primine reactors and warp generators.
Couldn't you have built a new airframe with less effort?
Mila shifted uncomfortably.
We could now, yes.
Steph looked up at the ceiling.
Why did it have to be my fighter she chopped for this damn experiment? Because I sure as hell wasn't going to let her play with mine.
Steph didn't turn around to see who was speaking, as he knew the voice too well.
You're such a prick, Raze. That's Commodore Raze, Eric said, walking up and looking over the work. Impressive. Will it fly?
Better than it did before,
Mila said. I consulted with flight engineers from both your people and mine. I would prefer time to properly enforce the frame against acceleration, just in case you lose the warp fields.
Does it have normal thrusters? Eric asked, cutting her off as he looked around for anything he might find familiar.
No.
Then if it loses warp, it won't be accelerating, I assume.
Well, no, she admitted.
Reinforce the production design, Eric said, clapping Steph on the back. Steph here can do without.
Oh, thank you so much, Steph muttered. Prick.
What was that?
Nothing, Commodore.
Thought not. Eric grinned at him before looking back to the fighter. Is anything still stock? What did you do to the gun?
Stefan would not permit me to remove it, Mila said. So I replaced the system with a Primine gravity accelerator. It is far more efficient than the magnetic acceleration that was in use, with higher yield. I am afraid that I may have depleted our stock of tungsten spars from storage in order to provide the ammunition. Ship's maintenance is rather irritated.
I'll transfer some replacements from the logistics vessels the Admiral sent, Eric said. Don't worry.
Mila nodded, looking relieved.
Eric didn't blame her. Having the ship's NCOs irritated at you generally meant for a long, irritating cruise. Even he wouldn't go out of his way to put himself on the wrong side of the non-coms, and he was the captain. A young lieutenant would just as likely find herself mysteriously without hot water, or with odd power fluctuations in her non-essentials. He let his gaze sweep the flight deck, coming to rest on the gleaming white drones now lined up in the ready launch positions, as well as others still under construction.
"Will those fly too?"
he asked with the tip of his head in that direction.
"Oh, with certainty, Commodore," Mila said firmly. "Those were far simpler to build than this."
She gestured over her shoulder to the Frankenstein beast that had been Steph's archangel as she spoke, then started walking toward the finished drones with Steph and Eric in tow.
"The most difficult part of the drone construction was the antimatter storage units," she said, "and even those were effectively off the shelf, only altered slightly from your own containment designs for the rogues. We use containment bottles and do not bother attempting to remove the antimatter from those, merely load the whole package into the transition cannon. Since we hardly care about what form the material transitions back into, adding a little more matter to the mix should have no detrimental effect."
Eric nodded, understanding the gist of that.
"And the drones themselves?"
"Extremely basic. They will follow commands from the designated flight leader, in this case Stefan, or operate autonomously to some degree. However, all of your people insisted that the weapons absolutely not be permitted to be controlled by the computer."
"I should hope not." Eric shook at the idea of putting that kind of firepower under a computer's control.
Mila glanced at him oddly.
"As you wish. I fail to see much difference between fire control being automated and the navigation systems. You are aware that should the drone decide to destroy something, it merely needs to fly into the target, correct?"
Eric winced. "Point. But at least then it's over. How many shots can the drone take with the cannon?"
"They are, in the parlance of your crew, 6 shooters, Mila answered. "That is primarily a design choice based on available munitions production rather than any integral limitations. I suggested 5 shots, but your crews were insistent that they work harder on antimatter production to supply an additional shot per drone. I do not understand your people sometimes, Commodore."
Steph and Eric both laughed, but it was Steph who answered. "We'll do a movie night," he said. "I have some old westerns that will cover what you want to know, but for now, just call it tradition."
"Very well," she said, gesturing mildly, still confused, but accepting the answer for the moment. "The flight control mechanism is very standard. Either your technology or the Primines could have done the job equally well. However, I used Primine designs because they would better interface with warp generation. Now that we have the basic design for the cannon system, we could produce these in massive numbers with little problem. Antimatter, of course, is another issue entirely."
"Detail your design, transmit it back to both Rankiel and Earth Command," Eric ordered.
Mila nodded absently as he looked over the assembled flight of drones. Eric's personal comm whistled, causing him to draw it from his pocket.
I need to get to the bridge, he said. We just received contact from the Bell. Keep up the good work. And Steph, you need to get these in space and soon for test flights.
You got it, Rays. I'll be spaceborne as soon as we can finish the final checks on my new ride, Steph told him firmly. Go find out what the hell the Bell and Bo have been up to. We've both got wingmen flying with them.
Roger that. Eric agreed as he started off down the deck in as much of a hurry as he would allow himself, short of a flat-out emergency. AEV Bellerophon, deep space. Deep space, out well beyond the fuzzy existence of a star system, was a stark place to view from almost any angle. Light from distant stars shone with steady perfection, no hints of flickering and twinkling, unless a distant nebula happened to be occluding them. Into that environment, the heroics and rogues of the temporarily shorthanded task group transitioned in a silent moment of defiance of physics.
Helm, confirm coordinates, Roberts ordered. Scanners, locate and project the Imperial course. Everyone else, get to work. I don't want to be out here any longer than I have to be.
A chorus of confirmations from the majority were his reward as he set about following his own orders. The deep black was not a particularly comfortable place to be parked in, though he supposed that might well be his planet-bound upbringing. Like some new seaman, he knew he had a preference for being within sight of land. The ocean of space was vast, however, and he wanted to deliver a message to the enemy that they were not safe anywhere in it.
Transition target met, Captain, Commander Little announced from the helm. We're right on target.
Thank you. Scanners? He called sharply, knowing that they had transitioned closer to the approaching enemy than he would prefer under most circumstances.
Got them locked, sir. No deviations in course to report. We're good.
With the Imperial formation barreling down on them at significantly over the speed of light, they were officially on the clock once more. As soon as Roberts got confirmation of the Imperial actions, he sent out the order to his own crew, as well as the other vessels.
Deploy, deploy, deploy!
The ships of the task force quickly set about their work, flushing the mines they had been building since the last group had been deployed. The rogues, in particular, had elected to leave packages of their own in the clear black. Deploying antimatter charges along with the CM mines, the squadron quickly left a mesh of death in the path of the oncoming enemy fleet. The whole process went as smoothly as possible, and in just a few minutes, the well-drilled teams had finished their deployment. Each ship reported back that they were entirely empty. Roberts watched over it all with approval before ordering the withdrawal.
Alaska, he said over the squadron network, you know what to do.
Roger, Bellerophon, the cool voice of Alaska Stanislaw, captain of the Juraj Janosik, answered back quickly.
We have this. Good flying, my friends.
The Juraj Janosik shifted on screen, moving under power as its hull plates changed frequencies. The rogue vanished into the black, only the occasional occlusion of a star marking its passage as the ship all but entirely disappeared from even the Bellerophon scopes.
All ships, transition to the target system, Roberts ordered.
AEV Odysseus.
Report, Eric ordered, stepping onto the bridge.
Transition event about a third around the elliptic plane, Miriam responded, clearing the command station for him as he approached.
Signal from the Bell shortly after. The squadron, all aside from the Janosik, have reported in and are standing by for orders.
What happened to the Janosik? Eric asked sharply.
Roberts ordered her to remain behind to observe the results of another of his little ambushes, Miriam said. All goes well, she should transition in shortly.
Sounds like a story, Eric said. All right. Inform the squadron that we'll rendezvous along the estimated arrival track of the Imperial forces. I have files prepared for the captains. Send those along as well.
Aye, sir.
Eric settled into his station again and examined the reports, skimming the titles quickly before reading the more important ones with a closer eye. Roberts had apparently been busy. He approved of the man's work ethic. Ambushing the fleet out in the black might be a bit of a mixed blessing, at least in theory. So far, the capabilities of the transition drive had remained secret. That wouldn't hold forever, but while it did, that gave Earth's forces mobility over the enemy and the ability to appear more numerous than they were. If the deep black ambush worked as planned, Eric expected that it would slow down the Imperial fleet and make them far more cautious. That would work in Earth's favor. There was no question of that in his mind. Time was the ultimate commodity, which the Admiral had charged him with acquiring. "Good work, Jason," Eric said softly, checking the details on their hastily rigged-together mines. They'd improved the designs since the first version, using camplate technology to make the small devices as difficult to detect as possible. Frankly, he wasn't sure that a heroic on full scan would have much of a chance of detecting it at anything less than point-blank range, and unlike the Imperials, heroics had detailed files on the camplate technology. Adding antimatter charges into the mix felt like it was only rubbing a little dirt into the wounds, given that Eric didn't think the negative matter particles were likely to make it through the forward warp of a large ship, but instead would get caught there and become a hazard that the crew would eventually have to deal with. Still, anything that caused them a headache was fine by him at this point. Eric began making adjustments to his new plans and doctrine based on the changes in designs coming from the Bell and Bow. He seemed to be doing that a lot of late, putting full fabricators at the fingertips of a bunch of motivated engineers and experts in their field and telling them to go nuts makes for a pain in the commander's butt. So noted, he thought with some amusement. Trying to keep up with the changes his people were making to their equipment was becoming a full-time job on its own. If these machinations gave them any edge against the Imperials, that was fine with him. The big issue, however, was that shipboard fabricators were simply not intended for mass manufacture. They might have enough for the new munitions for a single short engagement. If he allowed the battle to go on at length for any time, however, they'd be back to slugging it out with lasers against much larger numbers. And that could end only one way. We're going to have to sacrifice territory for time, Eric knew without question. A lot of people were going to suffer in the process, but he saw no other option. AEV Yuraj Yanoshik. Aleska had ordered the Yanoshik to drift after they'd cleared the predicted track of the enemy approach, silently gathering light through their passive scanners as they waited. She knew that the vessels would arrive before the scanners would detect them. It was one of the contrary natures of faster-than-light travel, similar to how old supersonic aircraft would arrive and be gone long before the boom of their travel reached observers. The first the crew of the Yanoshik would see of the enemy fleet would be a flash of Serenkov blue radiation. That was the equivalent of a superluminal boom. Immediately thereafter, they would begin scanning the light of the passing ships, which would dump tons of shifted data into the computers in a fraction of a second. Just decompressing that into something that resembled imagery a human could make any sense of would take all of the Yanoshik's computer power for the better part of an hour. It should make for a fun show, Aleska thought with a bit of grim humor as she looked at the ship's clock. Any time now, she said, eyes on the screen, though she knew that there would be nothing to see on the live feed. Computer decoding was needed to make any sense of what was to come, and at least then they'd have a recording they could rewind. Even with her attention on the screens, she almost missed the flash of Serenkov blue as the decoded imagery went live. The energy flash would probably be visible for 1,000 years in all directions, and might be mistaken for the birth of a new star. Ouch, something contacted antimatter, she thought, reflexively reaching up to shield her eyes, even though the screens had adjusted their brightness almost instantly. Initially, there was nothing to see, really. The light coming from the Imperial fleet was so absurdly blue-shifted, and then briefly, for a single instant in time, normal, and then abruptly red-shifted, as the fleet smashed through the field at insane velocities, apparently in excess of 100 times light speed. Honestly, at those speeds, no one was sure if any of the mines they dropped would have much effect. The sudden acceleration would possibly pulverize them before they could be initiated, which was one reason why she and the other rogues had elected to add antimatter to the mix. Despite other issues, acceleration would have zero impact in antimatter's effectiveness. "We've got a snapshot! On screen!" Aleska ordered. The single image of the fleet as its Doppler shift was reduced to zero was the easiest image to decode, and it was an interesting one to say the very least. Most of the fleet was blurred since the scanner technician had settled on a focused image of one particular ship that seemed to have picked up a star in its forward wake.
Aleska assumed that was one of their antimatter canisters, having had containment fail. There was no indication of whether it had been able to damage the vessel, however, which was more than a little disappointing.
"Continue recording. Track their path," she ordered. "Get everything you can."
She shook her head as the Janosik came around to follow her orders.
They just slammed right through it like a freight train on a track. Unbelievable.
Absently, Aleska sent the kill codes to the mines. No sense leaving them floating around, waiting to nail some random passerby in a year, or a century, or however long the power cells held up. It was unlikely, of course, given the sheer size of space, but the possibility remained. Explosions flashed in the black as containment failed on the antimatter charges as well, briefly eclipsing the Janosik as the ship began to track in the path of the enemy fleet, with its scanners searching intently.
Chapter 20. Lord's Own Dreadnought, Empress Leon, Deep Space.
"What in the Imperial Abyss was that?"
Yasan was picking himself up off the deck of the big starship, eyes wide with honest, naked fear and shock. He had never felt turbulence on a starship before. If he'd been asked before this moment, he would have sworn it wasn't even possible. Normally, at the speed starships habitually traveled, anything significant enough to alter your velocity unintentionally was also more than significant enough to plaster every human body within across the decks with nothing left but greasy smears and particulates of bones and teeth. That had happened, especially during the earlier days of space travel in the Empire, but being shaken enough to toss him out of his seat and across the floor, a painful but survivable experience? That was new.
"Unknown!"
"Useless response," Yesun growled under his breath as he checked himself for injury before hobbling over to his chair again. Slumping into it, nursing bruises and scrapes he'd received, he split his focus and started looking at the scanner information everyone on board was pouring through. They'd crossed paths with something, that was obvious. Something that hadn't been scanned ahead of time and yet was dangerous enough to have an effect on the drives. That narrowed the list significantly, as any sizable gravity sources would have been located in the quanta long before they passed.
"Most gravity sources," Yasan corrected himself. However, if they'd slammed into a young yet stable singularity, then he would be lucky to be a smear on the deck.
One of the officers around him spoke up, sounding hesitant. "Did we somehow scoop the corona of a dwarf neutron star?"
Everyone looked at the officer, one thought on all of their faces. Is he mad, or just stupid?
"I know how it sounds, my lord," the officer said, defending himself. "However, look at the scans from our warp trough. I've only seen readings like that around Leon Kora 12.
Yasan glared mildly, but did a quick check and comparison before responding. He wound up staring incredulously at the screens for a moment, shocked by the apparent match.
"There is clearly no way we flew that close to any star, let alone a neutron star," he said finally. "However, I do see what would make you draw the comparison."
The radiation was intense, and that was saying something for the leading edge of a warp drive. It was normal for all manner of high-energy particulate to gather into the sink of space-time that the ship plunged into as part of the mechanism of the warp drive. Over long distances, in fact, enough could accumulate to make the art of decelerating to sublight speeds a tricky matter of bleeding off energy in harmless ways in order to avoid murdering everything in your path with extreme levels of radiation. The readings he was looking at now, however, were evil from the abyss itself. If any of that had gotten through to his ship, it would have killed half his crew, and they would likely be the lucky ones.
"My lord, we have an issue."
"What is it?"
Yasan said, scowling at the communications technician, irritated by the distraction.
"We can't contact three ships. They dropped off our network, and because everyone was distracted by the energy pulse, even the computers didn't note the disappearance."
"Well, they noted the phenomenon, but it was logged as a temporary disconnection, my lord. Yet they haven't come back."
"Secure from Translite. Break formation. Be careful not to run into any more surprises," Yasan ordered. "Find those ships."
AEV Yuraj Janosik. Scanning debris, Skipper, Lieutenant Mika said, a hint of victory in her voice. I believe we got one. Aleska leaned forward, though it was hardly necessary to see the displays. She couldn't help it. She was as eager as her crew. The hurtling debris was on screen, hyperspectral analysis running. Apparently unencumbered by other forces, the debris was moving at significant